refresh our memories because it's been a long time. Shabtai Tzvi was declared. He was declared Mashiach by Nathan, by Nathan of Gaza. Shavuos turned 1665 in Gaza. They got mixed reaction. Specifically in Yerushalayim, the Rabbanim not only opposed Shabtai Tzvi, they also put him in Cherem. They also send the word of their Cherem out to other places. Chutzlaritz, however, there's mixed reaction because we know that not only did the Rabbanim of Yerushalayim send out their Cherem, but Nathan of Gaza also sent out his prophecy declaring Shabtai Tzvi Mashiach, that he's had a prophecy which says that. He also sent out his, you know, doctrinal ideas about why Shabtai Tzvi is Mashiach, what it means, the number of predictions. You know, also as mentioned, he partially deifies Mashiach, which, as commented on earlier, is not a Jewish idea. But Nassim of Gaza is a very slick, deep thinker, and it's like easy for us in retrospect to say this, but when it was happening, people were very unclear about it. And again, as mentioned earlier, Nassim was connected, both in the Sephardi and Ashkenazi worlds. His father was a known Mekobel, who had printed a number of years before this the second volume of Magen Mesharim. And that definitely is a major issue. Now, in the world at large, it was probable that, yeah.
Who do we say was the person that kind of looked into this and said, oh, this can't be completely right?
Yeah, we saw that. Rabbi Yaakov says Partus, and a couple of others. We're going to get back to some other people also. Yeah, as I think I was saying, it's probable, and probably more than probable, that in the world at large, up until this point, Shabtai Tzvi's quotes of strange actions were really not known. In other words, the places where he had been, Smyrna, Constantinople, Salonika, Yerushalayim, these are places he'd been. So these people were aware of it. But the world at large most likely wasn't aware of it. And that's also, you know, if you want to understand why most people accepted it, They hear this big, you know, big connected Mekobel telling them he had a nevuah, and Shabtai Tzvi said it, and they didn't know any reason not to believe it. So it was, you know, they didn't have the substance, the substantial questions that, as we're going to see, and we're not going to think we can get to it this week, we can get to it next week. After Shabtai Tzvi goes manic in Smyrna, then that's public. Then, because now he's a public figure, it's going to become public, and that's really going to, you know, totally blow things, you know, into, you know, super crisis mode. Okay. Yeah, and again, as we mentioned last time, I think Yosef asked a question, and it's not really 100% clear, but the question is legitimate. Why is it that Rabbi Yaakov Sosfortis is one of the only people who engages in, you know, what we call standard rabbinic analysis of the situation? So it's a mystery. It's very unclear. We see other people unclear and don't want to say anything, da, 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 da. And okay, so he wasn't holding a public position, and they were. But Lamaisa, there are, you know, as you say in Bisker terminology, there are dinim, you know. There is a process. Why did it seem almost nobody apply standard process, standard and analytical rabbinic process to analyzing the news? I don't know. It's unclear. It's not. There's no. At the present moment, from what I've seen, there's no clear answer for that. Okay. Fine. Okay. Shabtai Tzvi is traveling north. He goes up, as we saw, he was in Yerushalayim and Tzfat, and now he's going on to Aleppo.
On his own,
or is this
like...
On his own. Nathan stays in Gaza. He went to Hebron, goes back to Gaza. They're going to meet up much later. But right now, Shabtai Tzvi is out on his own, He first going north. He apparently wanted the entire time, most likely, he was hoping to get, quotes, home, back to Smyrna, back to Izmir, before Rosh Hashanah. He started traveling in Tammuz Av, going up towards Aleppo. Do we know what Aleppo, do we know anything, does anyone know anything about Aleppo? There you go, very good. Josh, very good. That is, all the SYs, not all, but a large amount of the SYs are from Swoj Chalab Aleppo. Chalab is next to Aleppo. Chalab to Aleppo is approximately the same thing as Gateshead and Liverpool. Or New York and New Jersey. We'll do it that way. Yeah. Or Philadelphia and what's that place called in New Jersey next to Philly?
Camden.
No, the Jewish community there.
Cherry Hill.
Cherry Hill. Philadelphia, Cherry Hill. Right? Okay, that's approximately the relationship between Aleppo and Chalab. Okay. Fine. Now, for the records, if you were not aware, SYs say that there's been a Jewish, whether there's a shul there, that was founded by Yoav and Tzruya. Whether that's true or not, who knows? But don't tell SYs that, they'll accuse you of kfir. Okay. Shabtai Tzvi comes to Aleppo, and in Aleppo he is relatively well documented. Relatively well documented. And quite successful. And the most logical approach seems, and this is not only a source, but some sources, but not at all, that Nathan had sent a letter to the people of Aleppo, saying, don't make the mistake that the people in Yerushalayim made. The people in Yerushalayim, Mashiach tried to come to Yerushalayim and they rejected him. Don't make that mistake. So, when Shabtai Tzvi comes to Aleppo, he has quite a success. He arrives in Aleppo, Ches Av, one day before Tisha B'Av. One day before Tisha B'Av. I was not able to see clearly if Shabtai Tzvi was. It does not seem he was manic in Aleppo. It seems he was normal. That's what it seems. I don't see any proof. He doesn't do anything that wild. He does meet people. They have big parties. They don't fast on Tisha B'Av. The entire city. More or less the entire city. It's unclear if there were any kofrim. They called the opponents of Shabtai Tzvi kofrim. And the people who sided with him were called maminim. Believers and non-believers. Kofrim and maminim. It's unclear if there's any significant amount of kofrim. It was possible there were. In other words, we don't have the amount when we hit Smyrna in a couple of minutes. Yeah, we were doing pretty good here. When we hit Smyrna, we're going to see we have a lot of excessive documentation of what happened in Smyrna. Three or four primary sources and secondary sources, and it's all over the place. We're really sure what happened in Smyrna. In Aleppo, we don't have as much information. So were there some quotes kofrim or musupakim? Very possible. I mean, you understand the guy could say a cute svara that in other words, he says he's Mashiach, right? Okay, so let's say you think maybe he's right, but you're not sure. I mean, he hasn't done anything yet. He himself admits. Nussan himself says, the real thing's happening in a year. So he claims, don't fast on Tisha B'Av. I don't know if everyone would listen to him. You know what I mean? It's sort of like the inverse of when the Mir Yeshiva was in Shanghai. Not Shanghai, in Kobe, Japan. Shanghai, they knew what you take, keep Yom Kippur to keep. But then when they were in Kobe, when they were in Japan, it's a big mahalak as a posuk.
What? How to keep Yom Kippur?
Which day to keep Shabbos in Yom Kippur? Shabbos is not as difficult, you know. So let's say you don't do melacha for Saturday and Sunday. So okay, it's a little difficult, but lamayim's a tachlis. So you don't do melacha 2 days, you know. There were yeshiva bachrim anyway, you know. So you couldn't write the chiddush Torah down. That's the only thing, right? What else do they have to do? Okay, fine. But the Chazon Ish famously paskened that Shabbos in Japan is on Sunday. Because the international deadline is a phenomenon. You can ask me over dinner, I'll explain it to you over dinner.
The Philippines Shabbos, like,
It's the same question.
There was like a whole thing this year, like they moved, this year they changed something in the Philippines, and like Shabbos, like...
There's a Jewish community in the Philippines?
No, but like, if there were to be a Jewish community.
Okay, whatever, we can talk about it over there. I'm just giving you an example. Well, the facts are, is the Chazon Ish told people to eat on the day that everyone else in the world held was Yom Kippur. And in the official story, in the official, you know, if you look at the Art Scrolls biography, it says everyone was in the Chazon Ish. Telling you right now, that's not true. And that, it's not clear at all who what the majority of people did. And even the people who be'ikar went with the Chazon Ish, a lot of them were machmer for the others, for the other Rabbanim. Because it's very hard that someone tells you this is a Safek Yom Kippur. I mean, he tells you it's not Yom Kippur, but my staff is like, anyway, whatever. So, v'chein ha'inyan when yaneinu, I mean, v'habdil. Because over here, you know, Shabbat Tzvi was a false Mashiach, a false Mashiach. But Umay Zatachas is telling you to do Tisha B'Av. You think everyone's going to go, okay, Tisha B'Av is not drop button. And that's a Doraisa, but still, Umayza. So it's hard to believe that every single person actually ate. But the community at large didn't officially sell, but didn't officially mourn on Tisha B'Av. Now, there's a very famous incident in Aleppo, which I'm not sure, you know, I'm not sure what you make out of it, but there was, quotes, a mass prophecy, which means a large amount of people had it certainly wasn't real. I don't know exactly how you define this, but they swooned, fell on the ground, and declared Shabbat to his Mashiach and said all sorts of mostly nonsense, etc. It wasn't mamash total nonsense. But as you know, Gershon Scholem brings a large text of one of their statements, which, as he points out, there's not really that much. It's mostly statements. You know, it's like someone saying, you know, someone davening without a sitter and messing up the words, like using lots of sitter / Tanakhic phraseology without like sort of goes together. But without any real original idea, thought in it, no originality there, and the self pasuk was Shabbat Ziz Mashiach. Okay, but that's a famous incident which happened in Aleppo.
How religious was the community?
Very religious. Everyone was largely religious. Were they all? You know, look, this is a fact. You know, it's hard. You're asking a difficult question. They were all religious on one hand. On the other side of the coin is how deeply committed everyone was is a hard question to answer clearly. In other words, they did not live in an open society. There was no really other real option. Converting to another religion wasn't really an option. I mean, it could have been done, but it was rare. It was very rare. If you look in the 1800s, okay, in Germany it wasn't so rare, but in the rest of Europe, it was Poland and Russia, it was very, very rare. That's a hostile society. Because the same thing would have been true, and you know, the Ottoman Empire wasn't as hostile, but it was very, very rare. How religious was committed? That's a good question. It's hard to say in a absolute, you know, one sentence statement. It's hard to say.
What did the chief rabbi?
Of Aleppo?
What did he do?
The chief rabbi of Aleppo followed Shabtai Tzvi. As a matter of fact, he has descendants alive today. They're not Sabbateans anymore. But I would tell you, I'm not sure, I'm very misupik if it's even usher for me to tell you what the guy's name was. But it's a well-known Halabi, you know, S-Y rabbinic name. Very well known. I don't know how well you know that. You know the Laszlo community well or not really?
I mean, it's a huge name. You might have heard of it.
Yeah, okay. It's not Sutton, but whatever. It's not Sutton, or let's see, what's the other one? Whatever. Yeah, okay, fine. I'm not sure if it's Isser or not to say it, but whatever. I'm recording, so I'm not going to say it right now. Okay. He goes on to Smyrna. He's going to get there. He wants to get to Smyrna before he leaves. Oops, he leaves Chalab. He leaves Aleppo around Rosh Chodesh Elul, and he wants to get to Smyrna before Rosh Hashanah. And I Baruch Hashem, was able to check this out on my computer, because Gershon Shalom, not being as religious as me, this is an understatement. It's an important fact. I was like, he has like a month. Now my question was, which day of the week does Rosh Hashanah fall on? Because that's important for traveling in the ancient times. You know, he obviously doesn't want to show up not only a day before Rosh Hashanah. It turns out that Shabbos was the Rosh Hashanah fell on Shabbos that year. So he had a pretty easy time. It wasn't, he didn't have to worry so much about his calculations. It took him about 3 to 3, and it took him at least around 3 weeks to get there, which is very normal. Again, I don't have a map on me, but you're talking about, he probably did not go by boat. If he went by boat, he probably could have done it quicker, because it's not that close, but it's not that far away. I don't think, unless it would be a very small boat, it shouldn't take that long. It's like, it's a solid, I think it's at least 400 miles. But by boat, that's not, a boat goes faster than that, Pashtus. I mean, 3 weeks, he must most likely went by foot. By caravan or something like that. Or former Roman road, something on those lines. Because it definitely was a Roman road, more or less, connecting the two. Okay, now, again, Smyrna is big, is a very public place. It's a major, you know, economic mercantile center. He's about to walk on to the big stage. He lived in Smyrna before, but no one really took him that seriously. Now he has a prophet who's claimed he's Mashiach. Nassan has sent out his letters. Nassan sent his letters out 3 months earlier. They have definitely hit Smyrna by this point. If it took Shabbat, it took 3 weeks to get from Aleppo to Smyrna. They don't say it took 2 or 3 weeks there. So he spent enough time, he spent 3 weeks in Aleppo. So the news, which was going from Yerushalayim, from Gaza up, has definitely hit Smyrna, Izmir by this time. Nazan's prophecy and instructions have definitely hit Izmir by this time. It's not, I was not able to pinpoint when they hit Constantinople, which is another three days to a week away by boat. Not yet been able to pinpoint that, but definitely he's going to spend enough time in Izmir and Smyrna back home that they're going to be very aware in Constantinople what's going on, and we'll see some of that soon. So now we have a lot of source about it on both sides of the story. In other words, there are Maminim, there are Kofrim, and there are non-Jewish observers, and they're all final reports on this massive piece of news. Shabtai Tzvi, home in Smyrna, and he stays there for almost 4 months, so he's going to have time to go Manic. Okay, yeah, again, just to, the rabbinic issue in Smyrna is like this. He was expelled from Smyrna around 1651, 652, not later than 1654. The former Rav, the former rabbi of Smyrna, Rabbi Yosef Iskafa, is no longer alive. He died in 1661. But most of the rabbinic players in Smyrna are still alive, and they know who this guy is. They know that Shabtai Tzvi is not stable. It's, again, as mentioned earlier, you know, before Pesach, I said, we're very unclear if they were able to, you know, have a real diagnosis of it. But they certainly were aware that the guy did crazy things occasionally. So, you know, they're aware. Now, he comes in, and initially, he behaves himself. He's not like Tzvi. You know, he comes in. It's not like Gershon Shalom thinks he was melancholy. He thinks he was slightly depressed when he comes in. I'm not sure. I didn't see why he brought. I didn't see any real proof to that. So I'm not sure why he says that. But he certainly was either melancholy or normal from when he came in Erev Rosh Hashanah until Hanukkah. That's basically 3 months. It's in a non-Jewish calendar. It's slightly under 3 months. With the Jewish calendar, it's, let's call it 3 months, okay? There's the entirety of Tishrei, there's a couple of days in Elul, the entire Tishrei, the entire Cheshvan, normally until Chafei Kislev. Right? So let's call it 3 months, okay? So he's normal for 3 months. He's basically normal. He goes to shul every day. He davens nicely. But, okay, that's what he does when he's normal. The only thing he does abnormal, but it's not so abnormal, is he gives out a lot of tzedakah money. Okay, it's time to say that's really bad. Now, look, he has, his brothers aren't poor. And he's also, he holds his Mashiach. And he has rich supporters. You know, we know the Chelubi, we know the treasurer of Egypt. He's a massive supporter of his. And it's likely to believe there were other major supporters. And they send him money. And he goes out to the stocker. Okay, you know. So the first 3 months, he's quiet. The Rabbanim in Smyrna don't react. Most likely, it's funny, he presents funny, but most likely what was going on was like this. They, A, knew Shabtai Tzvi. That's one side of the coin. They had a problem, though. They have a problem. Problem is that this guy, Nassim, has sent out these letters. He claims he's a prophet. He has a whole, you know, big Kabbalistic shtick of terror explaining why Shabtai Tzvi is Mashiach. He had a prophecy, but it makes sense. And explaining Shabtai Tzvi being Mashiach, etc., etc., etc. They are not sure what to. As a result of this, they're unclear how to react. They're very unclear how to react, and they're taking their time to making their minds up. Because it's like, in other words, what are they going to do exactly? They could try to expel him again, but he has more support now, so should they really do that? Is that enough? At a very key point in time, which is November, in other words, let's say around Rosh Chodesh Kislev, they get a letter from the Rabbanim in Constantinople. The Rabbanim in Constantinople say, kill Shabtai Tzvi. Okay, now, why the Rabbanim in Constantinople say kill Shabtai Tzvi?
Because they didn't want him to come here.
Well, it's not only that. They live in the capital, and declaring yourself Mashiach, it's definitely murdered by Malchus. It's definitely rebelling. The Turks had a custom. Now, the Turk custom changed, but the original Turk custom, Ottoman custom, was when someone became Sultan, he killed all of his brothers. Why? Shash murdered by Malchus. Because they might rebel and form opposition, he has the rights to kill. Later, at this point in Turkish history, instead of killing the brothers, they put them in what is called the cage. They locked them in prison.
A high-class prison.
Oh. And if the Sultan died, then you could march one of his brothers out. If he died without children, you could bring, quote, the cage, one of his brothers as Sultan. But again, the point is monarchies are always very touchy about, you know, rebellions. And the Turks are even a little more touchy. And obviously the Rabbanim in Constantinople are nervous of being accused of rebellion. So they send a message, kill Shabtai Tzvi. Now, the classic way, do you know the classic way they killed someone in
what? I was going to say, burn him at the stake.
No, Jewish way.
Yeah.
No.
Kippah?
No. Now, the way, the classic way, was get him in the mikvah. Sure, he doesn't come up. That was the classic way.
You have to use a mikvah after?
Yes, you are. According to the that is the classic way to Jewishly kill somebody. According to one of my, I'm actually not sure. I'll tell you the story, and I'll give you my editorial guide. According to one of my former rabbis, who kind of came from a European rabbinical family. He claims his great-grandfather did this to somebody. So it's recorded. Yeah.
Is there any like quotes of him while he's normal, not manic, of him like proclaiming he's Mashiach?
No. At this point in time, after Nassim declares a Mashiach, yeah. He said, no. Before Nassim says he's a Mashiach, he thinks he's a Mashiach when he's manic. When he's normal, he can't figure out what's going on. And when Nassim meets him, Nelson says to him, you're Mashiach. He says, I tried that, it's not Kedai. Nelson convinces him, now that Nelson convinces him Mashiach, now even when he's normal, he thinks Mashiach. It's just he doesn't do anything crazy. He leaves his crazy stuff for when he's manic. But he thinks, he definitely thinks he's Mashiach the whole time. So he gets Mashiach, again, he got back home to Smyrna, he spends around 3 months quiet. He definitely was telling people he was Mashiach, but, you know, that wasn't hurting anybody, and the Rabbanim weren't sure what to do. In other words, what are their options? What are their options? You can't, you know, it's enforcing, even though Svardi Rabbanim had a lot more power than Ashkenazi Rabbanim, a lot more power. And not only inside the community, also inside the Malchus. As commented, there's a major difference between the way, I don't know if we did this year a couple of times. When Muslims are doing well, they're very, you know, they're very, what's the right word? They're very, you know, benevolent and giving, and they're more tolerant when they're doing well. And the Christians, it's the other way around. So, the Ottoman Empire is at the peak of its powers. Okay, there's a certain decay already started, but they're arguably, most likely, the most single powerful country in Europe at this point in time. They are led by the famous Caprili, you know, Grand Viziers, and they're at one of their pinnacles of power. They rule, you have to understand, they rule from Hungary, the entire Balkans, about 20% of the Ukraine, the Crimea, Turkey, up the Caucasus, up almost meaning that they basically had the entire Black Sea was the Ottoman. Iraq, you know, Syria, Eretz Yisrael, coastal parts of Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Libya, Tunisia. That's a massive empire. They are the one singly most powerful country in Europe by far. Okay. They're lacking modern governmental ideas, but they were very powerful. And they're very benevolent and giving, and they allowed the Rabbanim to do it. I don't know if they could have actually killing somebody. That's another step. I'm not sure if they could do that. But the definitely Sephardi Rabbanim had the rights to flog. They definitely had the rights to give makas. And they didn't. And Shapazi had gotten makas. And I'm very unclear if Ashkenazi Rabbanim at that point still had that. I don't know if they had chera, but they didn't have makas to actually physically beat up. That's reserved for the king. But in a Muslim country, that wasn't reserved. They allowed the Rabbanim to do that. Okay. Okay, now, this is important for us to understand. There was, unfortunately, a major piece of communal politics going on in Izmir and Smyrna at this point in time. Communal politics, as we know, is a scourge of Jews. We all know the famous Jewish joke.
Two shoals,
the Jew on the deserted island. Okay, so it's a joke, but unfortunately there's truth to the joke. And there's unfortunately truth to the joke. And there's another, you know, permutation of this problem in Smyrna at this point in time. And it's important for understanding, I'm not stop saying it, because when we get next week, we're going to see the great fireworks. We're going to need to know the rabbinic politics in Smyrna. So we're going to go over the basics. Okay, Rabbi Yosef Iskafa had been chief rabbi until 1661. Rabbi Chaim Ben Avista, who, in case, you guys probably never heard of it, but he wrote a sefer called Knesset HaGadol.
When?
I'm not sure. Some of it he probably already printed, and some of it he printed later. It's a very large sefer on Dalet Chalkei Shulchan Aruch, and he's one of the known Gedolei Achronim. He's a known Gedolei Achronim, Rabbi Chaim Ben Avista. Now, the name Ben Avista, what does that sound like to you guys? What? What's Buna Vista? What does that mean?
Nice
view. Nice view, something like that? Okay, something on those lines. What language does it sound like to you?
Italian,
Spanish. So where are we going to assume? What, I mean, he doesn't bother saying it, but
Spain.
We're going to assume that Rukhaim Ben Avista is Sat.
Spain.
You know what Sat stands for? No, Sat. Svardi Tahor. You know what that means? That means you only married someone else who was Svardi. Okay? Pure. Okay? That's where you're going to assume the Reb Chaim Ben Avista was Sat and proud of it. And it was that one of the, I mean, most, I know all the Rebbeim, a very large amount of the Rebbeim were Sat. We're spotting to her a very large amount. And I'm not sure if that was part of the communal politics here, but he was not the world's greatest communal politician. They're not the same thing, you know. It's, they're Sveidinim, as Chris would say. You know, you could be a tremendous Talmud Chacham, but running communal politics may not be your expertise. That's how things go, can I tell you? So there was major communal politics. He had already been, he had been in Izmir Smyrna for a significant amount of time. He was definitely aware of who Shabbat Zvi was. However, because he was not the world's greatest communal politician, when Rabbi Yosef Iskafa died, they did not want him to become chief rabbi. Now, there was a problem. He is a major player, a major name, considered one of the, you know, one of important Talmidei Chachamim in his times. It was very hard to find someone to come in and step on his toes to get you. In other words, they wouldn't give him all the jurisprudence. They didn't give him all the rights that the rabbi had. And again, it's what he has. It dissuades, dissuades. The Seger Shalom has an interesting idea which makes logical sense, but whatever, could be not. So they're looking around for a number of years. Finally, can't be more than 6 months before the whole Shabtai Tzvi episode, they find Reb Aaron Lafafa to come in and be chief rabbi, or co-chief rabbi. Now, they give Reb Chaim Ben Avista is in charge of Archaim Yardaya and Abin Azar. Marriage and divorce, and ritual law. That's what he's in charge of. Archaim Yardaya and Abin Azar. And Reb Aaron Lafafa comes in, and he's given Choshe Mishpat. And Gershon Shalom wants to deduce from that that Reb Chaim Ben Avista had, you know, paskind. We know what Choshe Mishpat means? Legal. That means Dinei Torah. That means monetary stuff. Now today, I'm not, I, you know, wait just a second. In Eastern Europe, and certainly in Turkey, even people, you know, who is you? Is Josh, you the one who asked about religious commitment?
No.
I don't know exactly how religiously committed everyone was or wasn't, but no one doubted that they would get a better, you know, that it was very rare, if never, for two Jews to go to a monetary dispute to a non-Jewish court. Very rare. Now, there is a major problem when you have Choshe Mishpat, when you have a monetary dispute. You know what the major problem is? So one side's got to lose money. And as Shalom Shvajon says, he said, this is such a cute story. It's a cute mashal of Shalom's. He says, you have a man, he comes to the Rav, he's a merchant, and he sells beer and schnapps. He comes to the Rav, Erev Pesach, he realizes that he forgot to sell his chametz. That's after chatzos. What is he supposed to do? So the Rav tries to check the time, checks this, checks that, maybe this, maybe that, maybe the next. What am I supposed to tell you? It's after Chatzos and Pesach. All your beer and schnapps, chametz, and you have to get rid of it. There's nothing you can do about it. He said, the person will say, what can I do? It's Ratzon Hashem. He'll pour it all out. Shimon says, yafeh. That's very nice, isn't it? So let's say the same guy, a month later, he has a din tari, he has a monetary dispute with somebody. Over, not over thousands of dollars, over, you know, a small sum. And the Rav paskens, the other guy's right. So the Rav will never hear the end of it. I said, why?
Because someone else is getting
the loss. Ah, that's right. A person can handle their own loss. But to think that someone else gains, to think that you're being said to be in the wrong, legally, people don't like to hear that. So, it could be said, there's a way to tell someone, you know, you also have to have better, even in those cases, people understand someone's wrong. And if you're somewhat of a powerful and abrasive personality, you can step on people's toes, maybe even more than necessary, b'shel maybe possibly. And then we get to, there were people, Gershon Shalom wants to deduce that there are people in Smyrna and Zmir who did not like the way that Reb Chaim ben Avista of the Knesset of Gdova paskened Choshev Mishpat. And that's why they refused to give him all the parts, and that's why they brought in Rabbi Aaron Mufafa, and that's why things are going to get overly excited, which is what we're going to see next week. Okay, now let's go on. Okay, around Chanukah comes. And you know it, Shabtai Tzvi can only stay normal for so long. So he goes manic. Okay, so his first manic outbreak is what I call, for Shabtai Tzvi, relatively tame. And we're not going to get the real excitement, guys, in the next week. But he does come in. He has, is it in Hebrew? That means he's moved up a level. He goes manic. He walks into shul. He was going to shul every day before. But now when he goes to shul, he wears, like, royal garb. He wears royal garb. He walks into shul. Guys, I'm here. And one, as I believe we mentioned once or twice, one of Shabtai Tzvi's definite, without question, abilities was he could, when he said Tehillim, but Kavana, it was something else. It was always nice, but when he was manic, you could literally think he was a prophet. And that sometimes he comes in, you know, with decked out. I don't know if he had, like, you know, some jewels in his thing, but, you know, we could use our imagination possibly. And he's saying the Pesukah of Zimra, in a, like, unbelievable fashion, and making a real storm. Now, the initial reports like this, but these are all repeats, but he does it. There's actually one non-repeat. He gets people to say Shem Hashem, most likely by Kriyas HaTorah, but we'll see, he definitely does that later. He has people say Matir Asurim and Eat Chalev. That's one of his favorites. He's done that already once, and that's a repetitive. He does that and quotes other things. He does other things. What are other things? So Rabbi Yaakov Emden, who was a major anti-Sephardian 100 years or so later than this, accuses Shabtai Tzvi of loose morals. Whether it was him, his wife was with him, or encouraging people to do, you know, I don't know if Mamish had people sleep with other people's wives, or that's unclear, that detail at this point. But there is, the accusation is made. It definitely happened later in his life. You know, later in his life, it definitely happened. And it's very probable, it's definitely very possible, that even happened at this point in time. Now, whether he had to say Matri Surah before they did that or not, I'm not sure. That's not recorded, but that definitely happens. Okay, so at the same point in time, again, the Rabbanim in Smyrna have gotten, again, they know Shabtai Tzvi, and they've gotten conflicting reports. They have the Cherem from the Rabbanim Yerushalayim. They have Nassim's, they have Nathan's, you know, supposed prophecy, and probably some of his instructions Kabbalistic constructions, etc., etc., etc. So they're making their mind. This is also shortly after they've gotten this message from Constantinople to kill the guy. And they get together and they make up their minds to actively oppose.
What does that mean, actively oppose?
Okay. We're going to find out.
Actively oppose what?
Shabtai Tzvi. Who? So, Shabtai Tzvi, being manic, reacts manic. He reacts manic. How does he react manic? Well, he's Shabtai Tzvi. So he calls for a day of prayer. Because that's his favorite. That's Shabtai Tzvi said, how is he going to conquer the Ottoman Empire? He's not going to declare war. He's just going to daven. He's going to daven, and then he's going to keep davening, and walk straight into, quotes, the Grand Turk. In other words, the Sultan. The Sultan's going to take his turban off and hand it to Shabtai Tzvi as a sign of, you know, of accepting it. So Shabtai Tzvi declares a day of prayer. So if you think he was fancy before, he becomes more fancy. Now he comes into shul, not merely in his robes, he has two of his rabbinic supporters carrying the hems. And he has a scepter. Not a real scepter. It's not places described as a scepter. But Begashim Shalom wants to, based on, you know, and putting all the sources together, it was really a silver fan. He walks in with a silver fan, he uses it like a scepter, like pointing it at people. And the lucky followers, he hits on the head, or he touches on the head, and whoever he touches on the head with the silver scepter is very lucky. He doesn't do it to everybody. You got touched, don't shower for 3 weeks. Okay, fine. He comes in, and he's giving out candy and flowers. Okay, yeah, I don't know. That one I don't totally get, but it seems Gershon Shalom avers, which is, he makes it sound like that was the custom of the sultans to give out candy and flowers to their supporters. So he's like surprised why Shabtai Tzvi doesn't get in legal trouble for this, but whatever. Okay, so he goes in that, and he has a very, you know, Sabbatini, you know, classic Shabtai Tzvi. He changes around the order of davening. He goes up by the Kriyas HaTorah. By the Kriyas HaTorah, he knocks. He takes not his scepter. He takes his walking stick and knocks seven times on the Aron. Then pulls out the Sefer Torah, brings it down, calls people up, and has them all say, Shem Hashem. Of course, Shabtai Tzvi. That's right. He does. That's what he does. Okay. Yeah, let's do one more piece. The local Rebbeim hear about this, and this is major and clear deviations. They hold another whole slew of meetings, and they decide not merely to act and oppose Shabtai Tzvi, because notice before they were quiet, they weren't really saying much. So the first decision apparently was, we're going to publicly oppose. They now decide they're going to accept the proposal of the Rebbeim of Constantinople and kill Shabtai Tzvi. However, it's a problem. So deciding to kill someone is, quote, a lot easier said than done. Now, I'm just going to add in what I call an editorial comment. If they would have done it, they probably would have been, it's sort of like, it would have been an early version of, if Shabtai Tzvi would have died instead of becoming Muslim, I hope I'm not ruining it too much for you, but if he would have died instead of becoming Muslim, however many problems that he caused, they would have been exponentially, you know, multiplied. It would have been totally insane. In other words, Sabbatinism existed for a long time afterwards, and that was when he apostated. If he would have been killed by the Sultan, it certainly would have, who knows what would have happened. And I say, L'chara, if they would have killed him in Smyrna, I don't see that it would have solved anything. I mean, I hate to say it, but I don't see it would have solved anything. I think it would have been just as difficult of a problem It's hard to know 100%, but that's what it feels like. I don't think that would have really solved anything. If he would have been killed much earlier, okay, very good. But at this point in time, he already has significant following. He has Nathan, you know, sending out messages all over the Jewish world, and I don't think they would, that much would have been gained. Fine. Okay.
Would have been like,
Yeah, it probably would have been.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Okay, a pleasure like always.